Yes. You get three free sins. And you're way behind, so use them carefully. You know, as I've been doing a lot of interviews of late over this book, and we're doing a number of events in different places. And one guy said, "What can people expect when they come to your event?" And I said, "Well, we're going to bring apples and rocks. And if you get it, you can have the apple and you'll be blessed. And if you don't and you're irritated, you can have a rock and throw it at me. And either way, you'll be blessed." And that's really true. Another stoning of Stephen will take place in this thing. You guys are so so easy to talk to. You're well taught. And I can say, that doesn't mean that everybody agrees with me. During the Q&A time, we'll talk about some of the things that are bothering you, because it bothers every Christian. Are you saying, that doesn't matter if you sin? Listen, it does matter. It's destructive. You know, that's why I'm so messed up. If I could have been a little bit better, I'd been a little bit healthier. And so I'm not antinomian. I believe the Ten Commandments are not 10 suggestions. I believe. Do you know who Jeffrey Dahmer is? He's the guy that invited people to dinner and ate them for dinner. I mean, this is a bad guy. I mean, this is a really bad guy. They found pieces in his refrigerator and under his house. Well, anyway, I don't know how many people he killed, but he went to prison. And I got a letter. He was killed in prison by the other prisoners. And I got a letter from the chaplain at that prison and said, "Dear Dr. Brown, Jeffrey Dahmer was reading your book on grace the day he died, and I thought you would want to know." And I thought, no, I didn't want to know that at all. And it's going to be cold in a hot place before I tell anybody about it. And then God said, if it's not good for him, it's not good for anybody. And it really is. There's no limit to the grace. But there's no messing around with the law. And because I recognize the fact that not a person in here lives up to that law, that doesn't mean I lower the standard. The psalmist says the law is perfect. I'm driven. I opened. I'm on the staff, preaching staff of a church, large church in Atlanta. And I opened one time and people almost died. I said, there are millions of people going to hell and I don't care. I don't give a rip. And I said, now, if you're going to hell, that would bother me. You know, I've come to know some of you, and I like you. But I don't even know their names. I have people that stand in shopping centers and malls and weep over the lost. And I look at them and think, what's wrong with you? You don't know them. You don't know their kid's name. You don't know where they live. You don't know what kind of... How can you weep over them? Well, in the last about 10 years, God has started giving me a passion for the lost. And it's genuine and it's real. Somebody asked about the book, said, would this be a good book to give to some of my non-Christian friends? I think so. I have neighbors that I love a lot. We've lived there for 15 years. And they know I'm a preacher, so they know I'm religious. And I have to work hard at them not feeling condemned living next to a preacher. But I've never told them about Jesus. And I gave them both a copy of this book, and I don't feel guilty anymore. Because it was eaten alive, and they're fairly young, so I knew I had some time. But I really have a passion for not for you. I love you guys. I love the church. And I'm really a teacher of the church, not a teacher of unbelievers. But I care about them. I really do. And in the last 10 years, it really eats me alive sometimes. Somebody asked me what I thought about those guys that go and picket the funerals of soldiers, and they have signs that say God hates queers, and you know, they had a picture of them. I forget who they are. Asked me what I thought about them. And I don't care. You know, they're screwed up the way I am. And but the thing that bothers me about them is not them, but those who see them. Because that's not what this is about. It's not even close to what this is about. And when you give that impression that it's about that, and that's the impression that we give, when you give the impression that that's what this is about, then you do, well, unless you're a Calvinist, and I am, and you believe that you ain't going to mess anything up because God's sovereign, but it keeps me awake at night. I don't care what my theology says. I mean, I look at the world and I think, if you only knew, if there was a way, I'm a teetotaler, I'd get drunk with you if I knew a way. Because they think we're better than they are. They really do, by the way. And by the way, I've never known anybody that came to Christ because they met somebody who was better than they were. Ever. Duh. I mean, they're drawn to Christ. You know, whenever they see people they think are better than they are, they think it's not for them. Or they think we're hypocrites. And in their quiet moments, unbelievers think we're better than they are. That's why they're so angry. And that's why they say such stupid things. I did a skeptics forum in my study twice a year with about 15 atheists and agnostics. And I didn't allow other Christians to come. I was the only one. It was kind of a my daddy's bigger than your daddy kind of thing. We had so many new Christians in our church, and their boyfriends or girlfriends were making fun of their relationship with Jesus, or husbands and wives. And so I printed up, I got this inspiration to print up an invitation and invite them to Skeptics Forum. So they would say to a girlfriend or a boyfriend, look, I can't answer your questions. This is brand new to me. I don't have the foggiest, but I've got a pastor who'll eat your lunch. And he meets with people like you a lot, and you can ask him his questions. And I thought, you know, it's the easiest ministry I ever had. You know, I wanted to say, when they said things they thought were profound, I can't believe that you would say something that stupid. Have you never read a book? You have the brains of a peanut. This is crazy. But you couldn't do that. You had to say, well, that's interesting. Let's talk about it. And we'd talk. And I remember one psychologist who came cried the first time. And I promised I wouldn't pray for him publicly before their face or beat him over the head. I'd just answer their questions. And she started crying. And then the sob said, oh, God, I wish this were true. We had a guy who was a teacher in the public school system who was missing a hand. And the first night he stuck his stump up in the air and said, where the hell was your God when this happened? And we saw over a third of them become Christians. And we saw, and they quit laughing anyway. And during that time, that girl, that psychologist who said, oh God, I wish this were true, told me later, she said, I found out it was true, and sometimes I wish it weren't. And I began to listen to them and what they were saying, and God was beginning to put on my heart, not as an evangelist, I'm not an evangelist. I mean, I present the gospel when the opportunity arises, but I care about people who don't get this. Let me tell you why. When we get to heaven, I'll introduce you to my father. He's there, but barely. My father was drunk and a womanizer. I confronted his mistress when I was 12. He didn't have a father that anybody knew, so he was brought up by a single mother in the days when that was simply not acceptable, which makes me, technically, a second-generation bastard. You ought to announce that at a ladies' age social and see what happens. And my dad did some really bad. He was a pool shark. He never finished high school, but he was the head of shipping for a major industry in Tennessee and North Carolina and Holland. And when he'd gone Bender for 2 weeks, and they wouldn't fire him because they couldn't find anybody who was bright enough to do what he was doing. But the only thing he was better at than business was at pool. And I got this church in Boston to buy a pool table. Noel, if you'll tell your people it's for the kids, they'll buy you anything. So I'm glad to help. So we got a pool table for the youth center. And I'd go down there at night and practice. I got so I could beat the Nazarenes, which is no big deal. They can't play pool. But I got so I could beat the Baptist. And I got pretty good at it. And I wanted to, you know, I'd heard all these stories about my father. My mother was sure the devil resided in a pool hall. And so they came to visit right after he retired. And I said, "Dad, Daddy, let's go play some pool." My mother looked like she's going to die. We got out of the house before she exploded. She was not a nice person. She read Spurgeon in the morning and the Bible at night and taught me how to cuss in between. She wasn't manipulative or subtle. You did it her way, she'd break your face. And I loved her so much. I can't tell you. But anyway, so my dad and I went over and down into the youth center. And he went first, broke the balls, ran the table three times. Balls were jumping over balls and going into pockets. And then I never forget, he leaned on his pool cue, on his stick, took his bifocals off and put them down on the pool table and said, "Son, when I was younger, I was better." And I thought, oh my gosh. They said, who was the best pool player in Western North Carolina? They used to call him because he was an executive. He could leave when he wanted to. And he hustled hustlers. They'd say, well, Mr. Brownie is the best pool player in Western North Carolina. And they'd say, well, when he's sober. They'd say, well, who's the second best pool player? And they'd say, well, Brownie, when he's drunk. But I love my father. You know why? Because he loved me unconditionally. I've never been loved by a human being more than my father loved me. I have a brother who was district attorney. He died in his 40s, but he'd be the governor of North Carolina if he had lived. He was my kid brother. But he was a lawyer, and I was a preacher. My daddy used to say, I've got two sons. One's a preacher, and one's a lawyer. And no matter what trouble I get into, one of them can get me out of it. My dad never went to church. Well, that's not true. If we were singing in a children's choir or something, he'd come. And then as soon as we finished, he'd leave. I one time almost blew up a lady with a cherry bomb. I'm not proud of it. I was not a good kid. But we got some cherry bombs, and I threw it at the porch of this house. I didn't see the old lady sitting in the rocking chair. But I had a conscience even then, because from the foundation of the earth, Jesus was preparing me. So I went back, and they got my license plate. My daddy found out. And he went with me to the police with his arm around me the whole time. And she was all right, by the way, and then went to that man's house, and he held me the whole time. We used to steal cherry pies. I was a paper boy. I had a morning route. Because in those days, they used to put cherry pies out in front of supermarkets. And then when they opened up the supermarket, they'd bring them in. Well, we found out that. Let me tell you something, just so you know. I have never had cherry pie taste as good as the cherry pie I stole. And I can remember other guys saying, if my father finds out I'm history, he's going to kill me. And I remember thinking, even as a kid, if my father finds out, he'll love me. And that's worse. I mean, I had a theater. I had a manager of a movie theater that said I lied about my age to get a cheaper ticket. So I didn't get to go to the movies. And I told my father, man, he was livid. He went up and said, you call my son a liar. And he's a lot of things, but he's not that. And I thought he was going to kill this guy. And I got enough free movie tickets to last till I was 64 years old. I mean, they went all the way to the street, that guy. That's my father. But he didn't know Jesus. He never said bad things about us. He never called us hypocrites. Well, I know those people in the church. I'm better than they. He never said ever anything. He just didn't think he was good enough. 3 months before he died, a Christian doctor said, "Mr. Brown, you have 3 months to live. And we're going to have a prayer, and then I'm going to tell you something more important than what I just told you." And he told him about Jesus and his mercy and his grace and how he died for us, because none of us are good enough. And my father received Christ, and he's home now. But I guess that's one of the reasons this gets to me, because what is it that how could he miss that? I mean, that's it. That's the core of how we define ourselves. That's what this whole thing is about. We're beggars telling us, we're not former beggars. We're beggars telling other hungry people where we found bread. And that's it. And my father missed it. And he was around church people and Christians all of his life. And he missed it. He didn't think he was good enough. Where in the world did he get that? And so of late, God has given me a real passion for people like my father who don't know. And I want you to have that passion. I want you to care about your neighbors. I want you to go places. I was talking to Steve and his wife earlier. And we were talking about the early days of this church. You guys from Ames, Iowa came to the University of Michigan. It's a great, great story. Man, it's fun to have war stories and to be a part of something like that. We got a call at our office from a pastor in Ames, Iowa, not too long. He said he was going to be in Orlando with three of his deacons. Wanted to know if he could have lunch with me. And Kathy said, "Well, he'd love that, sure." So she set a date. And these guys show up, and they look like professional wrestlers. They're big old guys. This guy, man, he didn't have to worry about being the meanest preacher in the valley. He was just his size, and the three deacons, well, they all looked like professional wrestlers. They walked in, and I went, "Whoa!" So we went to this restaurant that I go to pretty often, and and they're loud, talking about Jesus all the time, and I want them, "Just calm it down. I'm a Presbyterian. Don't do it this way." And they came in, and everybody stopped and turned around because they were so massive. And this waitress who took us to our table, by the way, they liked me at that restaurant. I took two businessmen there one time, and they hit on this waitress. And she left, and I said, "Let me tell you something. You ain't going to do that with me here. You do that one more time, and I'm coming after you. You just don't, you can do it in your own restaurant, wherever you are, but you're not going to do that with me. So is that understood? And if it isn't, I'm leaving." And these guys never been talked like it. And they said, "Fine, we won't." And she overheard me. I didn't think anybody heard. Well, she told all the other waitresses, and now I'm the grandfather of this restaurant who carries a gun. Well, anyway, this waitress took us to our table, and one of these deacons gave her a $20 bill and said, "Honey," and I want to say, "Don't call her honey, that's sexist." He said, "Honey, that's not a tip." He said, "We're going to take care of you with a tip, but you were so nice when we came in. In the name of Jesus, I wanted to give you that." And then and people were listening to us, and we're talking about Jesus' love and stuff. I started to put a tip on the table, and I think the pastor hit my hand on it, and he said, "I told you, we're going to take care of that." And I said, "All right." And I don't know what he left for a tip, but that waitress was driving a Mercedes the next week. And then we got outside, and they wanted to take a picture with them, and somebody came out of the restaurant, and one of the guys said, "Son, come here." And he looked at him and said, "Yes, sir." And he came over, and he gave him a camera. He said, "Take a picture of us." So I'm in the middle of them like this. And then I was saying goodbye to him. I was walking out of the parking lot, and I turned around and I said, "You know something? You guys smell like Jesus." And one of the guys said, "And you smell like smoke." And then he didn't want to offend me. He said, "But very expensive smoke." And I thought about that. Barnhouse said all of life illustrates Bible doctrine, and it does. The two things you can't really, if you smoke, you can't hide it. If you belong to Jesus, you can't hide that either. Doesn't have anything with to do with being good. So you got to show. We can't be a lump of leaven here. We got to show. We got to show at places where they don't expect us. That's why I love Victoria Teague so much. She shows up at strip joints, and the strip club owners love her because she helps the strippers so much, and she has a halfway house so they can get out of that lifestyle. We got to show. You got to find your pagan friends. You got to go hang out with them. And you don't go and hang out with them so you are better than they are, so you can help. You know, every once in a while they come out with these studies that we have in the church, an exactly equal divorce rate as people who are not in the church. And then they yell at us about it. Say, we've got to do something. I want to go, are you crazy? I'm surprised it's not higher. Because we're so messed up and we've announced it to the world. I don't know how any husband lives with any wife or any wife lives with. Our divorce rate ought to go through the roof. No, it doesn't. And that's a gift of God's grace. But there's this idea that they think we're better than they are. And we're really not better than they are. We've got to somehow disabuse them of that. How do you do that? I don't think you can unless you tell them your sins. Do you know Don Miller in Blue Like Jazz? Have you ever read that? It's a great book. He needs a good editor. He's become a friend of mine. He's wacko politically, but he's so right on this. He was working at a ministry in Portland, and they were a small group of a holy huddle of a few students. And they had a big event at the end of every year where there was a lot of sex and a lot of booze and a lot of pagan stuff. And he said to these students, we're going to have a booth. And they said, oh, yeah, what are we going to do? He said, we're going to set up a confessional. And they said, they're not going to confess their sins to us. Don, are you crazy? And Don said, you don't understand. We're going to confess our sins to them. So they did. They set up a booth with a chair in the middle, and people would stick their heads in this tent and say, what's that? They say, sit down, we're going to tell you. So this pagan would sit down, and these Christians would surround the pagan and confess their sins to him. Now, I don't know if that's the way you ought to do it. But I don't know how we can witness as long as they think we're better than they are. Now, we are getting better. I'm sure that's going to come up in the Q&A. And I'm going to tell you then how I became a spiritual giant. But up until that, it's very important that we be so authentic and we be so real. And I'm going to read a text to you that... Actually, this text is usually used to condemn us. That's not what Jesus was talking about here. It's the 13th chapter of Matthew. As we think, what I've taught you in these first two sessions has been true, by the way. Don't let anybody tell you different. If they do, they're either lying or they don't know what they're talking about. And I do. And I'm old, so I don't care. I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm going to really, until I die, I'm going to be sinful and bloody, but I'm going to be here. And I'm going to keep saying it till I die. Listen to this. On the same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the sea, and a great multitude were gathered together to him, so that he got into a boat and he sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore. Then he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, behold, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured them. Some fell on stony places, and they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away, and some fell among thorns, And the thorns sprang up and choked them, but others fell on good ground and yielded crops, some 100-fold, some 60-fold, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Now I'm going to skip down to the explanation. There's a lot of great meat in between these verses, but that's not the reason for this session. So let me skip down to the 18th verse. Therefore, hear the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, then the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is he who received the seed by the wayside. But he received the seed on stony ground. This is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no root in himself and endures only for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles. Now he who received the seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. But he who received the seed on the good ground is he who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and produces some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. I've taught every book of the Bible, some of them more than once, a number of times. I've taught that parable 1,000 times. And it is such a wonderful place to make God's people guilty. I mean, do you have good seed in your heart? Are the thorns, are you so concerned with your lifestyle that the thorns are going to choke out your walk with Christ? Is the sun, Satan, is that going to scorch you? That's not what Jesus was doing. He's a friend of mine, and I know. Jesus was looking at this ragtag bunch of nobodies, and he knew them. He knew they were going to get discouraged. You ever had a friend that you witnessed to, and it looked like they were coming to Christ, and then they slipped into the darkness, and you just died over it? That kills a pastor. I've got a note in my files from a girl, I don't even remember her name, said, "Dear Steve, I'm leaving, and I didn't want you to hear it from somebody else." She said, "I tried and tried and tried, and I couldn't be good enough, so I can't do it anymore, and I'm out." And I tried to call her. Her phone had been disconnected. I never could find her. And I bring this up a lot in places where I go, hoping that maybe somebody will know who that was. Somebody, maybe she'll be there sometime when she says it. But Jesus looked out at the disciples, and we're not, by the way, we're not much. Let me read to you. I stuck this in my pocket, and I've got to share this with you, if I have it. Well, maybe I don't. It'd be a shame, because it's one of the great quotes in the history of the, if I don't have that, I'm going to kill myself. All right, I don't. Anyway, it's the introduction to Brennan Manning's book, It's All Grace. And you know, his best book was the first one he wrote, called Ragamuffin Gospel. Let me tell you about Brennan Manning. You know, he's a former priest, alcoholic. He used to stand before thousands of people giving witness to how he had gotten straight and go back to his hotel room and get plastered. And in this book, he decides to tell it all. And every other paragraph, you think, oh, my, I don't believe I'd have said that. I interviewed the man who wrote the book with him. And he's dying, Brennan Manning is. And he decided to come clean with everything. And the man we interviewed was in tears as he talked about Brennan and how real his love for Jesus is. He said that everybody thought he was a saint and he was reprobate. He said that the cheese had slipped off his crackers so many times that he said, "To hell with crackers." He said, "It's all grace." And I'm so glad for Brennan, who's willing to say that to us. Jesus knows that. Jesus knew about Brennan Manning. He looked at Peter Have you ever wondered what God was doing in the scripture? Do you know this whole thing began with a con game? I mean, with a lie. The whole covenant community was built on a con game by one brother over his brother to get a blessing. Did you know that Abraham, our hero, our forefather, lied about who his wife was and said it was his sister so she could sleep with the king? You know about David. It wasn't just the adultery, it was the murder. And then you look at Jeremiah, the magnificent prophet. He was a weenie. The reason he's called the weeping prophet is because he couldn't do what God told him to do. And he didn't want to. And he didn't think he'd do. Moses said, I don't know how to talk. Are you crazy? Go get somebody else. And then you move in the New Testament. It's not any better. You know, you got, if you get into Acts, you find out that Paul and Barnabas had a third world war, and they're believing brothers. I mean, they couldn't even work together. I can work with the devil. They couldn't even work with each other, and they both loved Jesus. They had to go in different directions over another kid who liked cherry pie more than he liked ministry and had left in the middle of the night and deserted the first missionary. He went back home to be with mama. And then you got Peter, and I'm not just talking about all the bad stuff Peter did. We had this tendency to believe that after Jesus in that last chapter of John says, do you love me, Peter? And he says, you know I love you. And then you get into Galatians and you find Paul is calling him a hypocrite. And that's holy. I mean, he was lying. He was faking it. And Paul called him on it. That's after. And then you get Paul saying, I want to be good, but I can't. And the evil I don't want to do is what I do. And sometimes I say, God, what are you doing? We need some heroes here. I'm dying, man. If I don't have somebody to hold up, what am I going to do? And then it dawns on me. If you have a biography of a famous Christian that doesn't tell you where the dirt is, burn it. It's not helpful. Do you know that I've seen Billy Graham biting his fingernails? Don't tell him I said that, but I have. I really did one time, and I thought, Jesus, don't do this to me. Billy Graham's not supposed to bite his fingernails. And people that you know and you've read, because they think I'm the worst of the bunch, they can tell me anything. I get confessions from celebrities that you wouldn't believe. And I want to say, why don't you go out and put that in a book? I don't believe any Christian author ought to write a book. And there are a lot of great books about the church and about where we've gone wrong and things that are bad. They should never be allowed to write a Christian book unless the first chapter details their sins. Then I listen to them. But we don't do that. So Jesus knew that what we were going to be like. We were going to go tell our friends and they were going to make an obscene gesture and walk away. Jesus looked at Peter and said, you know, Peter ain't going to last. You know, the first time that somebody turns down the witness that he gets, he's going to kick them in the shins. And then you got James and John, the sons of thunder. They're hell's angels. I did a bikers conference in Northern California 2 or 3 years ago with former hell's angels. My wife will not let me get on a motorcycle. She had a friend who was killed. She said, you get on a motorcycle at that conference, don't come home because you won't have a home. And she's just, anything. I could do anything. She'd love me except get on a motorcycle. But I had a wonderful time. I had a morning. Well, that's James and John. I thought about James and John that whole time. I thought that's who they were. I bet they had tattoos too all over their bodies. James and John. Then you get Thomas, who's a brilliant, self-sufficient, self-righteous intellectual. And Jesus would think he's going to the university and he's going to witness to me. And as soon as the kids won't listen, he's leaving. He's going to write a secular book on philosophy, make enough money to pay the mortgage and forget about this whole thing. And John, he's too sweet to pull this off. He doesn't have a mean streak. He's not going to make it. And so Jesus looked out and he said, and he thought about James and John and Peter and Thomas and Bartholomew. And he thought about Steve. And he thought about Noel and Dan. He thought about Sarah and Jane. And he thought about Sarita. And that's when he gave this teaching. You know what he was saying? Listen, people ain't going to like you. I mean, they're not going to listen to your witness. They're going to throw rocks at you. You're not supposed to be acceptable. You're supposed to be winsome. You're supposed to manifest the fruit of the Spirit, but they're not supposed to like you. So you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. Sometimes you're going to be the pigeon. Sometimes you're going to be the statue. Sometimes you're going to be the bug. Sometimes you're going to be the windshield. But that's the way it is. Don't give up. Keep persevering. I have on my wall, I have a board member who collects things, and he goes to these places, and if he sees a letter or something written by somebody that was a hero of mine, he'll get it and frame it and put their picture by it. So I've got hanging on my wall in my study, I've got Spurgeon, a personal letter handwritten from him. I've got a letter from Wilberforce, D.L. Moody, Ira Sankey, who sang with Moody. I've got a letter from Billy Sunday. I think Sankey sang with him. I don't know. But anyway, I've got a whole pile of these on my wall. And sometimes late at night, and I know where their dirt is. Spurgeon was bipolar, man. He was depressed more than he was up. And you look at somebody like Moody, who simply was lazy. Spurgeon, who smoked cigars. One time Moody went to visit him, and Spurgeon had a stogie in his mouth. Somebody asked Spurgeon, do you think it's sinful to smoke cigars? He said, not if you do it in moderation. And then they said, well, what's moderation? He said, smoking three at the same time is non-moderation. Well, anyways, Moody goes to visit him when he's at a crusade in London, and Spurgeon comes through the door with a cigar, and Moody fell down the stairs of those roadhouses. And he pointed up and said, how could you, a man of God, do that? Spurgeon took the stogie out, walked down the stairs and put his hand on Moody's tummy and said, the same way you, a man of God, could look that way. Jesus, when he taught this, thought about Moody. Thought about Spurgeon and the times when he wanted to give up. And sometimes I sit in my study and I look at those pictures and those guys speak to me. They say, don't shilly-shally. We wanted to give up too. There were times when we thought, this is crazy. Martin Luther almost gave it up. He came down from Wartburg, got a howitzer when he found out how screwed up his people were, and let them have it. And somebody said, Dr. Luther, would you have preached grace and the gospel if you had known this was going to happen? And Luther said, oh, I would have preached it more, because I would rather them know the gospel and not live it than I would for them to live it and not know the gospel. And so when Jesus did this teaching, he thought about Martin Luther. He thought about John Knox. He thought about Joel Osteen and R.C. Sproul, John MacArthur, and he thought about you. Luther said, we got to preach the gospel to each other, lest we become discouraged. And so this isn't about you. You're the seed thrower. Jesus isn't trying to beat you up because you're not growing right or because you like stuff. That's not what this is about. He looks at his people and he said, you know, they're going to get so discouraged. And then he said, guys, the seeds are not yours. They're mine. You don't have to do anything but throw the seeds. You don't have to do anything except show, because you smell like Jesus. It just doesn't matter whether you're good or bad. It's the seeds. And the seeds aren't yours. You wouldn't dream up something like this. This runs counter. It's counterintuitive to everything we ever thought. That's why the gospel is so radical. We're thinking, this can't be right. This can't be true. This is not. My teacher gave me an F when I screwed up. My mother spanked me when I screwed up. My boss fired me when I screwed up. And you're telling me God does just the opposite? Yeah. That's the gospel. But I wouldn't dream. I mean, if I was going to do a religion, it wouldn't be this one. I mean, it's too hard to explain. I mean, it really is. It's really crazy. We got a crazy God. This is way too hard to explain. I mean, I dream of something a little bit better than this. But this is the truth. and it's not mine. Grady Wilson was a friend of mine. He was Mr. Graham's sidekick. And I used to have Grady come and preach at my church, and I loved him a lot. He was a very effective evangelist in his own right, and he gave it up so he could help Mr. Graham. He said, God, you honor Mr. Graham, and I'll keep him humble. And he did. Grady was just kind. He was always there. He arranged hotel rooms. He was a servant to Mr. Graham. And I've heard Grady say on many occasions, he'd say something really controversial, and then he would hold up the Bible and say, I didn't say it. I wouldn't say anything like that. God said it. So deal with it. This is God's idea. It's not yours. You didn't dream it up. And Jesus said, the seeds aren't yours. Just throw them. That's it. Quit trying to pretend to be something that's way above your pay level. Just scatter the seeds. They don't belong to you. Because he knew the church. And he knew how if we couldn't pull it off, we'd fake it. So he said, just throw the seeds. I love church history, by the way. I have 8 volumes of the Shaft History of the Christian Church. I have Williston Walker's 1,000-page History of Christianity. I have Kenneth Scott Lorette, 1,300 pages of church. And I love to read church history. But I got a little book that I love by Stephen Tompkins called A Short History of the Christian Church. And he puts all the manure in one place. And Stephen Thompson is a Christian. But as I read through his little book, I begin to go, whoa, we're not a very faithful bunch. We really, do you know that story about Augustine after he had become a Christian and he was approached in the city by his former mistress? And she chased him down the road and she said, Augustine, it is I. And Augustine turned around as he ran away and said, but it is not I. That's a wonderful story. But let me tell you what Tompkins told me when he told me the rest of the story. She wasn't looking for sex. She was looking for food. She and their son were starving. She wanted Augustine to identify his son, patently his, to claim him as his own and to feed that kid. Puts a new spin on it. So you read Augustine's Confessions, one of the great pieces of literature in the church. And he says he felt guilty because he stole apples when he wasn't hungry. And everybody quotes that and they go, what a sensitive person. And I want to say, what about your kid you wouldn't feed? What about taking some responsibility for some of the deeds? But Augustine, and then Jesus says, I died for Augustine too. Just as I died for you. And what Augustine wrote and what he said when he wept when Rome fell and he wrote the city. That is such good stuff. But it's just seeds. He was throwing seeds. That's all you're supposed to do. And then it says, the failure's not yours. Not only are the seeds not yours, the failure's not yours. I've blown more witnesses than I can tell you. When you get your tongue tied and it doesn't come out right and you sounded condemning and you meant to say it a different way and you wanted to apologize but they weren't there anymore and you wanted to go and you just couldn't fix it. It was just awful and you thought, I am the world's biggest failure. I should not even be a Christian. And then you realize, that's not mine. That failure's not mine. I teach my students there's a 10-90 principle in the church. 10% are condemning. 90% will love you and make you cookies. And if you minister to that 10%, you'll get regular raises. And you won't ever have any fights in the church. And then you'll retire and go to an old preacher's home and you'll die. If you minister to that 90%, you'll go through some awful stuff. And if you survive, you'll have a healing place. But you got to decide. And if you do that, then things are going to fail. I just can't tell you how many pastors I talk to who've taken a stand. I talked to Paul Zoll, an Episcopal guy, who's so discouraged. He's a major scholar, PhD from Oxford or Cambridge, tremendous writer. Grace in Everyday Life will blow you away. And my friend said, Paul is so discouraged. Call him. Never met him. Found out he lived down the road from me. I call him. He's discouraged because they kicked him out of some places. So, failure's not yours. Don't own it. Doesn't belong to you. You're just a seed thrower. And then finally, Jesus says in this text, he's not beating up on you. He's saying the success isn't yours either. When the seeds grow, I can't grow anything. I one time got 2 prize roses and read books on growing roses. How to put the gravel in and to plant them in the place where they get the right kind of sunlight. I've watered them exactly the amount the book said to water. Those suckers didn't even try. I mean, there wasn't even a leaf on them. They didn't even try. And if you're a pastor, sometimes people grow and sometimes they don't. Sometimes you have a book that sells good. My first book was picked as one of the significant books of the year. It only sold 3 copies. One of them was my mother and one of them was my brother, and he wouldn't have bought it if I didn't know dirt on him. And I have no idea who the third person was, but it was the biggest bomb. And that's not mine. I told the truth in that book. All I got to do is throw the seeds and go get a milkshake and chill out. Because it's about Jesus. It's not about us. I had a heart attack 4 years ago. Now, I had it on Monday, so don't look so pained. Or joyful, whichever. I had it on Monday, and I was speaking for a convention in Nashville on Saturday. So it wasn't that bad. Buddy Green, who travels with me and sings, said, you got to watch Steve on this heart attack thing because he's going to milk it for everything it's worth. but it's kind of scary. I mean, I don't have that in my family. And cancer, I expect. A heart attack, I don't. So my arm, I thought it was a kidney stone at first. I am the president of the Fellowship of the Stone. You women who've been through pregnancy and how painful, you don't know nothing. You don't know anything. I don't believe I should have said that. But it really was. And I thought it was another kidney stone because I've been there. And then my arm, and I never felt a lot of pain, but my arm went numb. My wife said, I'm calling an ambulance. I said, no, you're not. And she said, yes, I am. And I said, I'm not going to have my neighbors see me leave this house in an ambulance. And she said, all right, I'm going to take you to the hospital, but you're going. So I went. By the time I got to the hospital, I was feeling okay, but I knew something bad had happened. By the way, I spoke right not shortly after that for the Easter sunrise service at SeaWorld in their big stadium. And they packed that sucker out. They turned people. My grandchildren got turned away. They couldn't get everybody in. They filled up on the sun. And I thought, you know, these people are fortunate to have me. And then I realized they're NASCAR people. It had gotten out in the media in Orlando, the Christian media, that Brown had had a heart attack. And these are the same people that go to NASCAR races. They don't want to see it. I mean, they don't want people to be in an accident. But if it happens, they want to be there. And they didn't want me to die of a coronary while I was preaching. But if it happened, they wanted to be there. And then the guy that asked me said, well, will you do it next year? And I said, no, I won't, because I'm not having a heart attack to fill up your stupid stadium. So I go, my wife takes me to the emergency room, there was a little young lady sitting at the reception desk. And as soon as I walked into Florida Hospital's emergency room, she said, Steve Brown, I can't believe this. And I went, don't do this to me, God. I'm going to cuss and spit and yell. And you got to put her here. I can't even do that. So I was angry and I sat down and she came over and she wanted to talk and she wanted to tell me about things she had heard and read. And I'm just thinking, I could be dying and I want to say damn. And I can't do it with you sitting there. So, but let me tell you what happened. And I just love her. By the way, if you don't get service in an emergency room, tell them your heart is in pain. Man, they get you through that. You don't have to sit around and wait. What? But it's true. Yeah, it is. Okay. All right. But I got through there fast. So there. And if I'd had an ingrown toenail, they wouldn't have hurried. Besides, you have no respect for the clergy. You're not supposed to answer. I'm supposed to talk. You're supposed to listen. That's in the Bible. What I was saying before I was interrupted is that I can't believe it. You know I'm kidding you, and I love you for that. Okay, I got it. You can straighten me out after it's over. Anyway, this little girl, they came to get me, and they were taking me back to go through all the tests and stuff. And she came over and she hugged me. And she whispered in my ear, "Steve, it's from Jesus. It's okay." And it was. I mean, I was reading it. My wife's going ballistic. I'm reading a novel. I'm so peaceful and so laid back. And I stayed that way for 2 months. And I almost died. It's called dying grace or whatever it is. But our whole lives ought to be like that. We ought to be able to have a milkshake because it's not about us. I get next person that I didn't read Purpose-Driven Life because I don't read books with purpose and driven in the title, okay? And I like Rick Warren, but if one more person says to me, "It's not about you, it's about God," I'm going to smack them. I want to say I'm a Calvinist. I know that, okay? I get that. But it's about me too. I love that poem where the guy says, goes before God, and God says, "I am." And he says, "I am too." Jesus went through a lot of trouble. So it's about me too. It's about you too. But this isn't. The seeds aren't ours. The failures are not ours. The success is not ours. So we can go have a milkshake. Go show. Throw some seeds. Get close enough to them so you hit them on the face with the seeds. And don't leave. And God will probably honor that. If I be lifted up, I will draw them into myself. Sometimes he won't. He ended on a cross, but it doesn't matter. You're not home yet, and the seeds aren't yours. You think about that. Amen. No, what do we do now? Do we... We've got one more session. That's Q&A.
I'm going to do it. Okay. We're going to do a Q&A, but let's do this. Let's do like a 10-minute quick break. Just kind of like, if you don't have to use the restroom, just kind of stand up and stretch. Then we'll do Q&A because we do want to end at 2 because we promised you guys can get on the road. What we decided during this last session is what we're going to do is we're going to do a Q&A. I'll go around with a mic. But if you have a question that you'd like to anonymously send in because maybe something's striking you don't feel like saying it publicly, we're going to put a phone number on the screen. You can text your question to that number. So we're going to go back and forth between questions that are asked out there and text questions as well. So you've got about 10 minutes, and then we're going to get started. So I encourage you not to go too far. All right? Thanks.